Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 133. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Ben Flanagan of AL.com.
How you doing today, Ben?
Doing great, Ben. What's up?
Well, we're over halfway through the year, a good bit beyond that at this point, but summer is wrapping up, and while we aren't, you know, the seasoned film critics that others might be in terms of, you know, getting access to screeners or going to the theater in some cases, both of us have young children at home, and life, these next few years for both of us probably, you know, life is going to keep us out of the theater for a good bit, which means that to really determine our favorite movies of the year, it's going to be March of the following year before we can really have a great assessment. But both of us have seen enough that we feel like we're pretty comfortable just throwing out a few titles to talk about in our top five favorite movies of 2016 so far. And we'll start with five and just go down to one, and maybe at the end of our talk we can talk about some of the other runners-up that we want to include. Sound good?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, why don't you go first with your number five?
My number five is Captain America Civil War, and it's arguably the most fun that I've had in a theater so far this year. And honestly, there's a very small sample size of that experience because I had a kid back in February, or my wife had a kid, we had a kid, and that has drastically diminished the volume of theater going in my life. And I'm having to resort to Redbox and Netflix and all these different streaming services and stuff to watch a lot of these movies that so many other far luckier people have seen in theaters in 2016. But I'm kind of in an I'll get there when I get there mode, and hopefully I'll be able to get to the theater more as like the end of the year and Oscar season sort of heats up. But that being said, there was no way I was going to miss arguably Marvel's biggest movie yet in a theater. Like, I had to have that moment in a dark theater full of a bunch of people on the biggest possible screen with the best possible sound that I could find, and it was a total blast. And there was so much hype over this movie before I saw it. It literally took me like part of a month to finally see this movie in the theater, and once I did, man, it was totally worth it, and it really was honestly one of arguably like the ultimate Marvel experience. And you know, we talked a little bit about what we thought about this movie a while ago on FNU, or maybe I guess it was Corey I spoke to about it on Aspect Radio. I'm getting my lo-fi movie podcast confused, but no, you know, it's everything everybody says it is. I mean, it's got just seeing all of those characters on screen at the same time and in all of these different roles, some of them simple, some of them complex, while tacking on this very thoughtful philosophy and thematic weight that you don't typically see in movies as big and loud and colorful as this. And it does make you think, and it forces you out of the theater to have a conversation with people about whose side are you on, because it is an actual weighty topic that is relevant to us right now, just in terms of how we might side if we were in the same shoes as these characters. And that might sound silly because it's a comic book, but they tried to apply real world philosophy to this, and there are some reflections of the current real world in terms of the nature of what the characters are dealing with. And for that to happen in the biggest summer blockbuster of the year is quite an achievement, in my opinion. And on top of that, the action is just outstanding. It's just absolute, you just get absolutely drunk on just junk food cinema, and it's wonderful.
Yes, it'll definitely come up on my list, but yeah, I totally agree with you, especially in the way that it uses a big canvas to tell a human and relatable and pertinent story. And I think that's so rare in a lot of these big movies. But it's also, you know, it's kind of rare in Marvel movies, which are often just more, a little bit more digestible, a little bit more popcorn. My number five is, it was a different movie, and I just called it just now because, well, I'll explain later what that other movie was, but my number five is in the same vein as yours. It's a big summer blockbuster that has something to say about our current moment and does so intelligently and with a lot of care and with a lot of heart, and that's Star Trek Beyond. We just recently reviewed it here on the show, so people can go get our full in-depth thoughts on that. But just in general, I mean, although it does suffer from some sketchy action scenes, on a whole, the character interactions, the overall story, the themes, many of the visuals, and an amazing Michael Giacchino score all combined to make a really satisfying, really entertaining, and really, for lack of a better word, sweet entry into the Star Trek series. And I feel like, as much as I love those Abrams movies, we're a little bit overdue for a little bit of the kinder, gentler Star Trek, and I'm glad that the director of The Fast and the Furious gave that to us.
Yeah, I really liked it too. Again, just a total blast, and I'm glad I've gotten a handful of those so far in 2016. Star Trek Beyond won't make my list right now, but it's a ton of fun. I got not much bad to say about it at all. It's great, so that's a good pick. My number four is Jeremy Saulnier's follow-up to Blue Ruin, Green Room, which has lingered with me ever since I saw it. And once I walked out of it, my first thought was, it's really fun and it's super well made, but it's just not quite on the same level as Blue Ruin. And I should have known better as a film fan just to walk in and walk out comparing that movie to another one immediately. And the movie did its job, and it just stayed in my brain for days after I saw it, and made me feel and look like a fool in terms of just reducing it to something that I could only compare to the previous effort from the filmmaker, and without immediately acknowledging how much he has clearly grown as a director and as a visual storyteller. There are just so many wonderful visual flourishes, and there's a lot of really great visual storytelling in terms of silent performance and physical performance from his actors, and he's got a great ensemble here, obviously led by the late Anton Yelchin here as the bassist in this punk band. They get stuck at this neo-Nazi punk club in the Pacific Northwest, and just the concept alone really sold me and turned this into one of the most anticipated movies of the year for me. But the concept as I was experiencing it, watching it, was just so thrilling, the way he executed it, and all of these different subversions of storytelling and sort of turning the sort of mainstream archetypical timeline on its head by surprising you every other scene in just in terms of taking the traditional narrative and just flipping it around and chopping it up and doing these different things and defying our expectations in really exciting ways. But yeah, there's just so much to love about it. Again, it looks great. The soundtrack is great. The characters are really interesting, and it goes in some really interesting places. So yeah, Green Room. And I've only seen it once too, and it's made me think about it that much. And it's one that I think really needs a revisit ASAP. So I might go grab that on Redbox soon.
Yeah, I mean, it was my number five up until I got on the phone with you. It's definitely an honorable mention. And like you said, it's one that I've only seen once. And for me, it hasn't stuck with me the way, here I am comparing it, but the way that Blue Ruin did. But I do think I need to look at it again, because there are definitely elements in it that that really stood out to me. And yeah, it may be, I think I went with, you know, my heart over my head with that number five slot, just because Green Room is such a brutal movie. You called it fun. I can't necessarily call it that, but it is in a very diehard way. It is very fun. You know, it's a very tense
ride. It's brutal for sure. Right. And it makes you feel scared at times in the sense that it's sort of, I guess, movie cousin Straw Dogs did, right? Where it's like, this makes me feel tense in really, in not negative ways, but ways, you know, I'm not really used to watching movies. But for me, like, if it can sort of drive that kind of energy within me while I'm in a theater and like legit put me on the edge of my seat and make me tense up, that's a fun movie experience for me. Like if the director of characters in the story can really make me feel something and make me hold my breath, and whether or not it's violent or brutal or fun and funny, either way, that to me is a positive thing to happen.
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of making me hate Star Trek Beyond now, but I mean, definitely, it's a movie I need to watch again, and I mean, this might be a great time for us to just go ahead and throw out that, you know, we should not be held to these lists, and if they aren't reflected in, you know, in the ordering of our year-end lists, then, you know, we don't, you know, that's not grounds for lawsuits or, you know, anything like that. This is, these lists could change tomorrow, and mine may have just changed while you're talking, you bastard. So that was your number four. So my number four is a movie that it was my number one there for a bit. I was able to rewatch it again recently, and the story didn't quite stick together, but the jokes still hit, and it's quite possibly the funniest movie of the year, and maybe the last few years. It's Shane Black's The Nice Guys, which is a really great kind of slacker noir in the area of The Big Lebowski or Inherent Vice. It's like I said, it doesn't have, I think its biggest failing is that it relies on its story a lot, but then at times it drops the story. So it's not like The Big Lebowski where the story barely matters and it's just about what's happening from scene to scene. It's not that loose, but it's also not so tight that, that everything really adds up or flows. So, but it's still a great movie and it's hilarious, and it has my favorite performance of the year so far in it from Ryan Gosling, who is a comic mastermind in this movie. And I don't think anybody saw it, but I highly recommend everybody go check it out. It's right there with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in terms of Shane Black as a director, but he clearly learned some things about big scale filming, you know, during his field trip to Iron Man 3. So it made me anticipate everything he's got coming up next so much more.
Yeah, you know, that's one that I missed this year, unfortunately. I blame the baby, and I blame its temporary status in my local multiplex. Sadly, it didn't stay very long, not long enough for me to see it, but it's
right.
definitely at the top of the list of movies to see before all is said and done, and hopefully I'll be able to grab it on Redbox soon. But, yeah, you know, honestly, I was a little low on Shane Black for a while. I like most people, I like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I'm not a big fan of Iron Man 3 and what he did, and I know there are a lot of people out there who love it, specifically because of Shane Black and things he brought to Marvel and that franchise, but it ranks last for me in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And, yeah, you know, and I'm guessing that The Nice Guys is a pretty drastically different movie from Iron Man 3, so I don't feel right about holding that against him for too long, and I like those performances. I'm glad, you know, Ryan Gosling was a guy who's really hurting for compliments, too, so I'm glad you singled him out as a comedic mastermind. I mean, if you can't have everything in the world, I guess, then you might as well toss in comedic masterminds to everything else he has, so appreciate that. My number three, you know, you said that we're going to change these lists maybe as we're talking here. I've forgotten what my number three is. And so what I'm going to do, I don't have my list in front of me.
I know which one it is then. Okay.
Well, well, instead of going with whatever I had written down, I'm going to go with the most recent movie I saw that I think is going to creep up my list as the year goes on, and the more I
Jason
think about it, yeah, it's Jason. It's Legend of Tarzan, but no, it's The Lobster, and this is a movie. I know you could. I think most people consider it a 2016 release, even though
I would say so.
A lot of people talked about it last year, I guess, on the festival circuit.
Those film festival snobs are not welcome.
Yeah. So I watched The Lobster yesterday, and it's quite a movie. It's unusual as it's as unusual as I think you expect from this filmmaker. And I learned how to pronounce his name yesterday, but now, again, my memory fails me, and so I've forgotten. So I'm not going to butcher his name, but he obviously is the director of Dogtooth, and that movie is probably as bizarre as it gets in wonderful, in many wonderful ways. But this guy is just, if people are pining for original storytelling, then this guy's work is whom I would refer them to immediately. I mean, you're not going to see anything like what this guy is doing in terms of world building, language, rules within the universes that he creates, and absolutely hilarious deadpan performance. And Colin Farrell is one of my favorite performances of the year so far, is this sort of sad sack in this, I don't think it's post-apocalyptic, but this not-so-distant future in which everybody under this totalitarian government or regime in the not-so-distant future is required to be a part of a couple, that you have to be man and woman or man and man or woman and woman in the future for society to move ahead. And if you're not with somebody, if you're divorced, if you're a widower or a widow, you're sent to this hotel where you have 45 days to find a mate at the hotel. And if you don't do that, if time is up, then you turn into the animal of your choice. So this is clearly a fantasy. And as you're watching it, it's strictly through language, and it's strictly through them laying the groundwork for the rules again that this filmmaker and his co-writer have come up with. And it's all sorts of bizarre, but it's a wonderful commentary on societal expectations of us to be with somebody or to not be with somebody. It takes both stances on romanticism and on marriage and on love, and it has a lot of really interesting things to say, again, on both sides of the fence. It makes great points for each. And again, this guy is just a really vibrant and exciting voice in movies right now. He's a Greek filmmaker who has a few interesting movies under his belt, but I'm guessing that The Lobster is going to be the first that most American movie fans are going to be exposed to. I know a lot of people know who he is by now, but this is his first movie in the English language. It has movie stars like Colin Farrell and Rachel Weisz and John C. Reilly in it, all of whom are really, really good. So I can definitely recommend it. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but it's worth watching.
Yeah, I, for some reason, the only name that keeps coming to my head is George P. Cosmatos, and I'm almost certain that's not this guy. I don't think this is the Tombstone guy. But I saw Alps, and I didn't like it. I felt like it was a really interesting premise. It was similarly kind of fantasy or high concept, where there's like an agency that you can pay to have somebody come by and pretend to be a dead loved one, which, you know, that's a pretty rich premise, but I feel like the movie was obscured with its own tone and distance, that it didn't really ever get to the heights of what that concept could be. But I'm hearing nothing but great things about The Lobster, so it's definitely very high on my list of movies that I want to check out this year. My number three is another reason why I think that I may have left Green Room off, because I felt like I could only have one super tense chamber thriller on my list. And so my number three is 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is a movie that, you know, I think it snuck up on everybody, but I think it has kept sneaking up on me since I've seen it. It's a movie that it keeps getting better every time I think about it. It has a third act that I think throws off a lot of people, but at the same time, I feel like that it's still in a internally satisfying third act, and I feel like that it's a movie about the moment, about, you know, what are we. About it's about generational lines, you know, and how do we talk to one another, and how do we reconcile with one another? And it's a movie rich with all those things, but then at the end of the day, like you said, it's the same way the Green Room is. It's just this super tense experience and the super tense ride, and from the opening shots and especially the opening credits through the end, it's just this breathless experience, and I can't wait to watch it again.
Yeah, it really flies by. Like, you can't wait to get to the next thing as you're watching it. Just, like, you want answers, and you want them immediately, and it has a really fun payoff. And, yeah, it's like you said, it's breathless, and the director is I think he's quite a talent because, I mean, that, like you said, a chamber thriller, like, we found out about that. It's like you said, not many people really, it snuck up on everybody. It had to sneak up on everybody. Like, we only knew about it, like, 2 weeks before it came out or something insane like that. It was a wide release. It was a big studio movie. And you got to give props to, was it Paramount that released it? Or I can't remember who, but,
yes,
man, like, yeah, like, that is not, that premise in the way, like, how that movie works is no guarantee at the box office. And I believe it did really well. And its budget, I believe, is modest. And so I'm guessing this is not the last time we explore the shared universe of this Cloverfield series. So, what's his name? Dan Trachtenberg is the director, correct?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I used to listen to his podcast. So it's one of those very – it's at the same time, you know, jealousy-inducing, but it's also very very fun to have somebody that you knew – when they were just some guy in L.A. doing podcasts, and now he's this big filmmaker, and not just a big filmmaker, he's actually a pretty fantastic filmmaker. I would recommend everybody listen to the Q&A podcast interview with him, because it's a really great insight on how the movie happened and how hard everybody worked on it.
Yeah, as a podcaster / aspiring filmmaker, I would think that you would have to be pretty happy for this guy, right? Because there's no telling how jealous he's been in recent years of people who have had similar success, and you can kind of sense that in the interview you're talking about with Jeff Goldsmith, this guy who you can just tell how giddy he is about finally sort of arriving to where he's been working towards for so many years. And those kinds of guests on podcasts and interviews like that are really fun. You're just very self-aware and very, very pleased to be sort of in that moment without coming across as, like, overly conceited about it. So I agree with you. That's a really good interview. And that's a good pick. It's a good movie. Just missed my list. So my number two I recently caught up with, but, man, oh, man, I loved it. It's Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some. One, again, atop my most anticipated of 2016. And Richard Linklater's must-see every time. And I think, you know, you had some really great words to write about Wes Anderson a couple years ago when Grand Budapest Hotel came out, just about how we kind of take Wes Anderson for granted, you know, and how talented this guy is and how much great work he gives us movie in and movie out. I feel the same way about Richard Linklater, and I know plenty of people love him, and he got more exposure than he has ever gotten last year when Boyhood came out, got nominated for all the Oscars, and got a swarm of media attention, but the guy just doesn't make bad movies. I mean, all he does is make really good movies and really thoughtful movies. And it might seem slight to some people, but there's typically a lot of really positive, thematic, and philosophical weight behind each of them, or at least there are a handful of moments in each of the seemingly small movies with smaller characters doing smaller things. But I don't really find that to be the case. I think they hit you pretty hard, and you think about them for a while after you see them. He's one of my favorite directors to listen to talk about his work and just talk about movies in general. His WTF podcast with Mark Maron from not too long ago is fantastic. He came back on that podcast to talk about this movie, and it was really good. And I'm a big fan, clearly, of Dazed and Confused. I know it took you a while to finally see it. It was on the shelf of shame for a while, but it's one of my all-time favorite movies. And to just know that there was a quote-unquote spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused on the way was enough to get me really excited. And it definitely delivers on that hype aspect of it, but it's its own movie in a really big way. I mean, it's just a different crowd of kids. It's a different clique that he follows around. Dazed and Confused is all about there are some popular kids and they're high school football players and there's some hippies, there's some outcasts in the group, and they kind of follow every different sect of high school on the last night of school as they go out and party and get the summer started. And Everybody Wants Some, he's following around the baseball team. They're jocks. They're guys who have it made. They have bright futures. They're going to be well connected. They're going to have a brotherhood for the rest of their lives. They're in great shape. They have, you know, they get free booze and, you know, they get girls and everything is just right in their world. So I think that his biggest challenge going into that movie was, how do I make these guys relatable? How do I make them likable? And to me, that's the biggest strength of this. He makes all the guys really super likable and creates a really fun dynamic. And I think he sort of challenges you to hate these guys and to root against them, but he earns your trust and he earns sort of like the audience's admiration and friendship and connection with these guys. Because I think the way that he does this is, the way he writes them is as very open-minded young men and individuals who aren't satisfied within their own boundary, and they're not afraid to broaden their horizons and explore different sects of people, different kinds of people, different kinds of music and clubs and aspects of things that make college so great. And so that's why I really like it. The soundtrack is great. The humor is fantastic. It does, again, it has that thematic weight, and it ends on just an extremely powerful moment that made me really appreciate the movie and Richard Linklater as a filmmaker. So I highly recommend everybody watch them.
Yeah, that's another one that's high on my list. I'm way behind on Linklater. There's a bunch of his work that I still need to check out, including the entire Before trilogy. But you're right. I have seen Dazed and Confused and really liked it a lot. And I'm definitely interested in seeing Dazed and Contused.
Whew.
Ooh. My number two is a movie that you mentioned earlier. It's Captain America: Civil War. Like you said, it's just great big screen entertainment. And loyal listeners of Film Nerds Unlimited, I would say hi, Mom, now, but that wouldn't be true, might remember that in my immediate review after I saw the movie and after Matt saw the movie, and we talked about it a few months ago, I was a little bit mixed on this movie, and another viewing definitely helped. I think it is a great movie for most of it. I think there are still a few things that just in terms of easy outs, in terms of character dynamics, and I mean, I guess I don't want to spoil anything, but the kind of reason that the interpersonal conflict comes to a head at the end of the movie is still a little bit shallow for me and still a little bit cheap. And there are just some logistical things about it that don't entirely work for me. And I do think it takes a tone that it's a new direction for a Marvel movie. And I know a lot of people hate the Marvel movies because they're shiny and positive, but that's
kind
of one of the reasons.
Who hates the Marvel movies? I hate to interrupt you, but I don't know many people who hate the Marvel movies. They make trillions of dollars.
About the few people on Twitter that I see talking about that are fabricating this DC versus Marvel conflict.
You mean the Suicide Squad petitioners?
Yeah. The people that think that Batman v Superman is a great movie because it doesn't feel like a Marvel movie. That's the marginal criticism that I'm addressing. And just by even mentioning it, you're right. I'm just kind of basically making up an entire group of people.
I'm sure we'll talk more about Batman versus Superman on your number one, but so we'll wait on that.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
We totally will. Thanks for spoiling that. Not to go too far into all that, I think it's still fantastic. Like you said, it's just pure movie candy. It's such a good time, and it's amazing how much stuff is going on in that movie, and yet it still feels like everybody gets their stuff in. So that's my number two, Captain America: Civil War.
So you sound like, first, you sound pretty down on your number two, to be honest. Like you said, the second viewing helped, but here it stands as your number two ahead of all these movies you've already talked about that you like a lot. I'm curious, though, you mentioned that there are elements of it that play shallow. What about it do you think? What are some examples of why you think it's shallow?
It's really hard to talk about without spoiling it. And I mean, I guess everybody on the planet has seen this movie. So I'll just throw up. I'm about to spoil like the major twist or reveal in this movie. Basically, the idea that Bucky killed Iron Man's parents and the how much he knew about that or how much Cap knew about that, and it doesn't feel very well drawn. I've seen the movie twice, and I still don't exactly understand what the hierarchy of knowledge is there. And then the fact that they had to go there, I felt like they had just this really, really great tension going on, and then they resorted to, "You killed my mom!" And that's, I don't know, it feels like a cheat. It feels like a shortcut. It's well set up in the movie, and I can't believe I'm giving so much airtime to, you know, my one quibble with the movie, because to answer your question, the reason it's my number two is because everything else in this movie is, like, great, like, A-plus, like, top whatever comic book cinema stuff ever, or just movie stuff. It's just great stuff. The action is great. The characters are great. It's so much fun. It's just that one little thing that at the end of the movie left me with a weird taste, and then I saw it again, and I was like, okay, well, in the internal logic of the movie, it makes sense. It's just not playing that great to me personally, but it's not so major that it doesn't stop me from loving the movie and thinking it's a fantastic movie overall and one of my favorite movies of the year so far.
Here's why it worked for me really well and why it elevated the movie from what it was, which was just kind of a trifle of a great time, like the junk food thing, because I thought that it was earned and really motivated. In that, I love the moment where Tony Stark decides, okay, look, we're friends here. Let's set aside these political differences. Let's fight the common enemy. Let's work together, even after 2 hours of just this sudden antagonism among friends. And right when they decide to do that, he gets new information, and it gets personal. Right? Like, at first it was political, it was about business, it was about what's right for the world, what's right for the country, and then as soon as he gets personal information, everything changes, and that all that stuff just immediately goes out of the window. And for me, it works so well because that's how human beings really respond. They act emotionally, and they forget about logic and reason and how you came together in the first place at an instant. And I just thought that was a really great human character motivation that, again, it amplified the tension for me. So
that is good. And maybe it just comes down to the way that it's staged. Maybe like the, you know, Bucky is, it's revealed in this camera footage on a tree. Why was there a camera there? Like, why did he shoot the camera out after he did the murdering? And then, but then we also move into these close-ups, and you get a close-up of Bucky's hand around the Iron Man's mom's throat. It's that kind of stuff that it's just like, I don't know. Like, it feels like, look, that you're right. It's a big emotional human moment there. So why do you have to ordain it in this kind of false, haunting way? It's just the way it was presented. It's probably, I don't know, it's a directorial thing or something. I'm not
so
sure.
You thought it was contrived, basically?
Yeah, I thought it was contrived, and then I thought visually it was overwrought, I think is maybe a good way to explain it.
Would you put it in the same category of silliness as most people do the Martha thing in Batman versus Superman?
No, because that wasn't ever set up in that movie. In this movie, you understand going in why Iron Man has a sensitivity to his parents, and especially his parents in that moment that they were killed in. You know, I mean, we see that CGI flashback, you know, of him having an argument with them before they leave. So it's thematically rich and it's character rich. So I don't have a problem with that.
Wait, and I don't want to get sidetracked here, but during the opening of Batman versus Superman, when we get the 1,000,000th rendition of Bruce's parents getting killed, doesn't Bruce's dad say Martha as like as he's dying. I mean, I could be wrong here. I need to go back and watch it, but
probably. But that's again, that's not Batman's motivation for doing anything with Superman in the movie. That's just Batman's motivation for being Batman. So it doesn't
but it's like
really...
his father's dying breath. So clearly, that's a pretty significant memory that he carries. And also, it kind of there is a parallel here, sort of in reverse, where it's all business for Batman, and he's working on behalf of all of mankind and protecting them from somebody who is potentially dangerous and clearly is dangerous from Man of Steel, as Superman. And then once something personal happens, he instantly changes his mind in the opposite direction that Tony Stark obviously does. An enemy becomes someone with common ground.
I mean, you're making a better case for Civil War here because Tony makes an emotional decision that is still logical. You know, it's still a one-to-one, like, oh, wow, I agreed to work with this person, putting aside my political and personal differences with him. I'm going to work with this person until I find out this new piece of information that is even more personal, and now I need to deal with this person directly.
Now it's just straight-up vengeance.
Yes, yes. So that makes sense. But with Batman Superman, it made very little sense. Like, that's, I guess, the leap from diplomacy to vengeance is an easier leap for a person to make than from vague anger, vengeance, to specifically being able to relate to another person for a really
humanity,
dumb reason.
Like, humanity steps in the way, where it's just like, wait, this guy has a mom that he loves. I have mommy problems, too. Like, it is silly, but I get the fundamental motivation.
I get the fundamental motivation of the entirety of Batman Superman. I just, the problem with the movie is that it doesn't illustrate that in the movie. Like, I can talk about how it might work all day long, but that's fantasy booking, and we're not allowed to do that. But yeah, so it's a decent parallel to draw, and I think maybe the first time I reacted to Civil War at the end, that may have been one of my problems with it. I was like, ooh, this is a really close to that other thing that I didn't like in that other movie. But like I said, it thematically works. Again, it might just be staging and then blocking and camera stuff. And then also the last shot in the movie is they're going for this kind of monumental kind of cliffhanger thing where this, like, you know, Captain America's speech goes on this kind of philosophical thread, and then you end that with this, like, powerful shot. I can see they're going for the Dark Knight thing, you know, where it all leads up to Jim Gordon, you know, explaining who Batman is, and then he says he's the Dark Knight, and it's like
right.
Shot of that. Just talking about it gives me chills.
Captain America goes rogue.
Yeah, and it's that. They're trying to get that, but whereas in Dark Knight, the shot is like Batman, like, running away on his motorcycle, driving into the light. This is a close-up of Chris Evans stepping into his mark. And that's it. And then it cuts. He's not in his Captain America garb. It's just him. There's just something that just falls flat to me for that. And it's such a big moment that, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense for me to pick on the Russos when they put together this masterwork of complexity before that, in terms of visuals, in terms of character dynamics, but I gotta be honest that it kind of falls flat for me. It fell flat for me both times I saw it.
Interesting.
Anyway,
yeah,
that's my number
two
movie, and it's funny to me that you're calling me out for having it my number two, but you seem to have zero problems with this movie, and it was your number five.
Well, no, I don't have zero problems, and you know, I don't want to talk about it at length right now, but the good clearly outweighs the bad, but it's interesting that you mentioned the final shot there, because if you think about it, Marvel, there are several cases where the movies end on very slight final shots and cuts, right, to the credits. And in fact, Captain America Winter Soldier too, it's like a medium close up of Captain America and the Falcon as they're about to embark on chasing Bucky, and then it just cuts to black. And then you have Avengers Age of Ultron, where
that
Captain America, he's addressing the new Avengers, or the current group of Avengers, and it's just, again, it's a medium, it's like a medium shot of Captain America.
That moment works well, because he's about to say Avengers Assemble, and Whedon cuts it. That's like Iron Man, you know, with Tony Stark saying he's Iron Man.
Right, or Iron Man 2, right? Like, they're not whimpers that they end on, but they're just like, you know, very light, jokey jokes. You know, like in terms, but my main quibble, the Ultron moment is really good. Even the Captain America Winter Soldier moment is effective, even though I don't care about Bucky all that much. But I just think visually, a lot of the Marvel movies end on very slight moments.
That's an interesting side note. We could do another 3-hour episode about that, about just final shots in Marvel movies.
Yeah, totally.
It's on my notepad.
I've done a lot of soul searching about my number one so far this year, and hang on a second. Am I about to say a Michael Bay movie is my number one movie now? Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and do it. God help me. 13 Hours, Michael Bay's Benghazi movie, is my favorite movie of the year so far, and it I don't know, on the surface it might feel wrong because Michael Bay has been so bad for so long, with maybe one or two very minute exceptions in things we like about Pain and Gain and The Island and even the last Transformers movie, somehow, some way. I know you're a fan of that movie, actually.
Whoa. I'm not a fan of it. I just think it's not horrible. Basically, if a Transformers movie is better than Revenge of the Fallen, I'm okay with it.
Well, okay, so see how embarrassed you are about the idea that you might like a Michael Bay movie, especially a Transformers movie? It's mostly been really bad. But
yes.
I, as an enormous fan of The Rock, or at least clinging to the memory of the 12-year-old who saw The Rock in the theater, I love that movie so much that forever I'm going to give Michael Bay a shot. And somebody I know and have always known has been this master technician, somebody who directs action in a way that very few can, and always creates something beautiful and interesting in a given frame for 2 to 2.5 hours. I think for those reasons, he's a guy that you have to at least pay attention to, even if you only respect him, again, as a technician or even like a music video director, right? Like, the stories haven't been all there. The scripts have been really bad for the most part, yet he keeps making them, and they keep making money, so nothing's really stopping him from doing that. In fact, he's not done with the Transformers movies. And then we get word that he's going to make the Benghazi movie. And I think everybody slapped their foreheads as soon as they heard this news. But when I saw the trailer for it, I thought, whoa, this actually looks pretty awesome. And this looks like that Michael Bay that I talked about, the guy who makes great action movies. And unfortunately, he was once again working with a real-life event, a tragic event in our history, the way that he did with Pearl Harbor. So if we get something similar to Pearl Harbor, which definitely has its merits technically, then we're in for trouble, because it's a travesty what he did with that story in that moment in American history. And so I, like everybody else, was skeptical that he would do it again. But it turns out that he got a good script with 13 Hours, something that is very bare bones and straight to the point and is not political and just strictly focuses on the moment and the people directly impacted by the events of the Benghazi attack as it was happening almost in real time. And it makes for an just insanely intense and purposeful and really powerful movie that I think is not only underrated, but has somehow been the movie that really captivated me more than any on this list so far in 2016. I don't know that it's made me a believer in Michael Bay again. I don't think that Michael Bay's next movie is going to be as good as this, or any of his movies will be as good as this. We might have another 20-year hiatus like he had with The Rock in 13 Hours. But for whatever reason, in this moment, 13 Hours, it really caught me by surprise and reinforced the fact that Michael Bay is a superior action director, and given good material, he can make a damn good movie, and that's what 13 Hours is, and people should give it a chance.
Wow, it's weird for you to pick a documentary as your number one.
All great points. It's a fantastic movie, and I think a big part of it is that it's written by the guy that made Eraser, Chuck Russell.
So I think that he's just got this pedigree of a great action director, somebody that knows how to get from point A to point B without a bunch of, you know, fussing around. And I think that shows in the final movie. And I'm with you. I hope that this signals a new Michael Bay that takes on scripts that are thoughtful and straightforward and not marred by a bunch of ADR robot lines about pop culture. The thing that kind of blew me away the most with 13 Hours was his willingness to draw the Islamic fighters and then also just the regular people in the rest of the movie as human, you know, and he gives them moments, and I felt like, wow, that's not just great for Michael Bay, but it's also great for the kind of, you know, the audience that might watch this movie as pure entertainment. You know, it doesn't allow you to just see these fighters as faceless drones that we're supposed to go out there and slaughter. So I think that played a big part in my enjoyment, not enjoyment, but my respect for the movie. And I think that respect is the number one key word, I think, when it comes to this movie. And I think he had a lot of respect for the material, for the people, the real people involved on both sides. And he did his job and told a human story in that. And it still has some of its Michael Bay flourishes. It's 4.5 hours long, and it has some questionable comedy bits, I think. But most of them are just...
One.
Most of them are just the character lines, you know, where it's just like, man, that guy, that macho dude just said something that was supposed to be funny and it wasn't. But at the same time, you think, that probably happens all the time. Yeah, I know when you're just around a bunch of macho dudes. I wouldn't know. I hang out with you guys. So I think it's fantastic, and I think it's a fine number one. I'm glad that you're giving it a little bit more more exposure here on the show, because I think a lot of people probably have written him off or, you know, did that a long time ago.
Yeah, and I fear that they've written this movie off, again, just because Michael Bay directed it, and it's the Benghazi movie, and there's an easy joke to be made about him making that particular movie. I think it was written off before it ever came out, and I doubt many people gave it a chance. And for me, that's a shame, because it is really good, and I think it has really good performances, too. I want to single out James Badge Dale, who I think the guy has so much charisma, and I think he could be a legit action star. And I don't know if those exist anymore in Hollywood. I mean, I think that there's a short list of guys who could pull movies like that off, but James Badge Dale, to me, is one of those guys. He could be in a movie like Die Hard, right? He could be in I'm trying to think of good examples of like old action movies that depended on the charisma of their leads and guys who could pull off the physicality of it too. He's one of those guys, and he's terrific in this movie. Pablo Schreiber, also very good. Toby Stevens, who I believe was in Pacific Rim as the Australian father.
That's right.
Jaeger. Really good cast they've assembled here, and it just made you care about the situation and what those guys actually went through and the horrific event that they had to survive, where they had to protect so many people, and it puts you right there, and it's absolutely horrifying. But Michael Bay deserves a lot of credit for realizing it on the big screen in such a quick turnaround. And again, like, it's one of the most politicized moments in recent American history, and Michael Bay probably wisely keeps politics out of it for the most part. Because I don't know that politics are necessarily Michael Bay's strong suit. So good on him for leaving it out. I want to make one quick correction here, Stark. Chuck Russell actually didn't write the movie. A guy named Chuck Hogan did.
Chuck Hogan.
He's a novelist. He wrote the book that the movie The Town is based on. He wrote the Strain books that Guillermo del Toro's I think collaborated with him on. And 13 Hours is actually his first screenplay.
What a dumb thing for me to say, but you made a great point that look, my point stands is that he worked with somebody with pedigree and with a strong resume for telling good stories. Boy,
not the director of The Mask, though. No.
Totally not the director of The Mask or The Scorpion King. Wow, excellent. That's great that I worked that so much into the conversation that it's impossible to edit out. So it's just going to stand as a monument.
Leave it.
My dumminess. All right. So my number one is I'm shocked that it's not on your list anywhere, and maybe it's in your honorable mentions. Maybe you haven't seen it yet because it made $0, so it probably didn't stick around any theaters very long. And it's a movie that I saw in the theater and loved, and then I was like, well, this movie falls in a filmography that I just can't keep putting these filmmakers' movies at the top of all my lists. Like, I can't. Like, I have to be grown up about this, and I can't just keep handing out gold stars. You know, they eventually have to have a movie that isn't as good. But it's not happening for whatever reason. I recently rewatched it, and it was obvious that it's the best movie I've seen this year. It's the Coen Brothers' Hail Caesar, which, have you seen this movie?
Yes, I have, and it's my actual number three that I forgot.
Ah, I see. Got it.
But you go ahead.
Well, good. Then we can kind of ping-pong a conversation about it, because I'm glad you like it. It's great, and it's a movie nerd's, like, dream in many ways. But it's so much more than that. It posits this alternate universe where this particular movie studio is basically is a microcosm for the world and the universe in a way, where this world has a god, this world has a functional Christ-like savior, this world has, this is a world where communism is a real threat, where the Russians do have people implanted in the culture to I guess change minds. It's wacky, strange world, but it says so much about our own history, our own moment, and about movies. My movies are important, and maybe they're more important than we give them credit for, or maybe it's also silly that it shows just how silly movies are to begin with. It's a complex movie. It's not easily analyzed, but it's very entertaining from moment to moment. That's one thing I was struck with the second time I watched it, was this, it moved so fast. Like I it's just over in a bit. We mentioned earlier, we used the word trifle to describe Captain America Civil War. And this is a movie that feels like a trifle. And then you sit and think about it and you realize just how much you were thinking while you're watching it. And it's so effervescent and it's so fun, and it loves movies so much, and it's so good at being a movie. And the performances by Josh Brolin and George Clooney and Scarlett Johansson and everybody that plays any of the communists or the communist writers, Channing Tatum, everybody in this movie is just, they just know they're in a Coen Brothers movie, and they've got to lay it down. They've got to bring their A game, and it's fantastic. It's easily in my top, well, it's not easily in my top 10 Coen Brothers, because that's a hard list to make, and it's just frustrating that these guys keep making great movies and keep putting everybody else to shame.
Yeah, and I loved it too. It's so much fun, and I can't believe I forgot about it during our initial, like earlier in our conversation. And you know, it's interesting because it is 100% a celebration of movies. But I think there's an argument to be made that there's it works as a kind of condemnation of the studio system in ways, in the levels of control that exists within the Hollywood studio system, or as they did at one point, and maybe there are parallels in terms of how that all works today, but I choose to ignore a lot of that when it comes to the celebration part of it, especially like the Coen brothers. If you watch interviews with the guys, if you know what their affect is like, they come across as just like really sort of bored with the world guys who are kind of snarky at times, and you know, but for the most part, like their work does not reflect that. They guys are obviously joyful people who have great senses of humor because of those things that we have seen in their movies throughout their just illustrious careers. And that same thing is true in Hail Caesar, in it, when they are celebrating a Hollywood that once was, in showing that these are the type of movies from yesteryear, back during the era that they're depicting, those movies can still be made. There is just an evolution in the process and in the industry and in the points of view and the sensibilities of artists and filmmakers and obviously the studios that drive them to make different kinds of movies. But the fact that they can recreate that era in those types of movies, musicals, westerns, swords and sandals movies and what have you so easily and so tangibly, it almost makes me wish that we still lived in that era. And it made me miss those movies. It makes me want to explore just sort of the bevy of movies from that era that I haven't seen. And there are so many, and there are so many forgettable movies like that too, that people never talk about. Yet if you go back and watch this forgotten movie, no matter the genre that it's a part of, then you see that nothing like that exists today. And I just think that these guys obviously care so deeply about movies. And for me, the biggest strength of this are those moments when we see the musical being made, where Channing Tatum is leading this chorus of sailors during an amazing musical number, or when Ralph Fiennes is directing young Hobie.
I totally forgot to mention Alden Ehrenreich and Ralph Fiennes.
Well, I think you suppressed the young man because he's the next Han Solo, and I don't blame you.
I won't hold
that.
It against him. Yeah, no.
Yeah. So no, he's probably he probably gives the best performance in the movie.
Yes.
Let's be honest, and it's a great character, and you file him under one of the, you know, in the category of great Coen characters. He'll be on the short list for many, I'm sure, just as like Cy Abelman was for me as soon as I saw him in A Serious Man not too long ago, or even Llewyn Davis in their last movie. So, yeah, my favorite part about this is when they recreate those movies and they celebrate that aspect of Hollywood that they and we obviously clearly love. Just to know that there are filmmakers who have the talent that they do that can make that sort of revive that spirit of Hollywood again. It makes me feel good as a moviegoer.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned that it's kind of an indictment of the studio system, but again, I go back. It's not nearly that simple. You know, there's a love for it too. You know, the end of the movie, the final confrontation between Brolin and Clooney, you know, it's such a great moment that Brolin just kind of throws the weight and the strength of Capital Pictures around, and you're like, yeah, like this stuff matters, movies matter, and if they matter, then you know, they need to be done correctly and with respect. And it's great. It makes you cheer for this kind of strong man, and it's crazy. But also the movie, it poses arguments against the studio system and movies in general with the guy from Lockheed that's offering Eddie Mannix a job and is kind of saying, like, look, you could be part of the apocalypse. Like, why wouldn't you want that? And in general, there's this apocalyptic feeling over the whole movie. So, and the idea that the only saving grace for this little universe that they've created is that these movies keep getting made and that this order is sustained. So there's just so much going on. I could keep talking about it for hours, but yeah, it's clearly my number one, and I can't wait for whatever movie boots it from that spot, if indeed that happens, because it'll be a great movie year if that happens.
Yeah, and I say Hobie is the best character and arguably the best performance in the movie. Josh Brolin is so good as Eddie Mannix, and he is just a sort of a, I don't know, he fits so well into what the, he obviously gets what the Coens are going for in the things that he's collaborated. He was excellent in No Country for Old Men. But man, to me, this is even late in his career, kind of a breakout performance for Josh Brolin that really shows why he keeps getting cast in so many high profile projects as sort of a background character or very much a supporting character. You could even say that he's a character actor to an extent, but Josh Brolin is a leading man too in this performance as Eddie Mannix, this conflicted Hollywood fixer who stresses about the most minor things as he's in confession at church when he's actually like he just toils over these absolutely just trivial things and doesn't even bother to mention or even think about the high pressure situations that and responsibilities that he really has that seem to not bother him in the least. And I just think that's such a funny character and such a funny dynamic, and Brolin just absolutely murders their dialogue, like, in the best possible way.
Yeah, and the realization late in the movie where he's like, if you're good at something and you do that, does that make you a bad person? You know, like, what's wrong with just doing something that, like you said, like, it's hard for him to be a good husband, but it's or not a good husband, but just a totally transparent husband. But it's easy for him to run this extremely complex machine. And it's a great moment when he kind of realizes that this is where God, a.k.a. Nick Skank, financier of the studio, wants me to be. It's fantastic. I'd be remiss to mention that, not to mention the amazing scene of the religious leaders in the conference room with Eddie Mannix as they try to, nail down the, as they try to identify the nature of Christ. It's just one of those scenes where you can't believe what you're seeing, and it could only happen in a Coen Brothers movie. It's just crazy. I mean, look at the link between our two movies, our two number ones. It's crazy to think that one of the writers and directors of Hail Caesar wrote those last two Transformers movies. Well, are there any other movies that were very close to making your top five?
Yeah, and it's mostly the movies I've actually seen this year. As we get older and as we're raising kids here and going to the theater less, we're having to be very choosy about what we see, and so we typically go see movies in the theater that we think we'll really like, and most of the time it turns out that we do. And Star Trek Beyond, definitely one of those. Finding Dory, really good. Zootopia, I think, is very good, really funny, and is actually, on top of being just a really funny, delightful Disney movie, it's actually a really good cop movie too that you can file in that genre. 10 Cloverfield Lane, you already talked about it, is really good. That Steven Spielberg movie that came out, the BFG, give it a shot. Give the young guy a shot if you feel like it. Totally super weird movie, but wow, it really is a lot of fun. I caught up with Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special not long ago, and I think for the most part it's really good, and it is one of those that kind of ends on a whimper, unfortunately, but the guy clearly has a ton of talent, and I think we'll be seeing much more of him in the very near future. I am one of those guys, one of those people who likes Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, and I've only seen it the one time. Maybe I'm being stubborn in my affinity for it, but I do think that it has plenty of merits that have gone largely ignored by the people who walked into it wanting to hate it and walked out of it wanting to reinforce that thought. And I caught up with Deadpool, and I like Deadpool fine, but I can't understand how it's made as much money as it has. So that does it for me.
Yeah, those two are on the bottom of my list. I'll second Zootopia, Finding Dory. Piper, the short that aired before Finding Dory, is great. Green Room just missed my list, and you know, like we talked about earlier, it may actually need to be on the list. I think the new Ghostbusters is really fun and entertaining. Midnight Special was very good. But yeah, it's and yes, absolutely, the BFG belongs in the conversation too, and you know, that's one that with subsequent viewings may climb up the list as well, because the first time you see that movie, you walk out of the theater asking so many questions of it and of yourself and what you just saw, and it's a supremely bizarre $180 million Disney movie. So yeah, I think so far it's been a really fun year, and I mean for me, really the big thing left this year that I was highly anticipating is Martin Scorsese's Silence, and I'm probably forgetting a bunch of other titles that I'm looking forward to seeing, but really that seems to be the big one sticking out for me that I think might make a big impact on my list at the end of the year.
Yeah, there are a handful that I still want to see that are available to me now and will be soon. You mentioned The Nice Guys. I need to see that. I really want to see The Jungle Book. I've got The Witch at my house right now. I must see The Witch. I want to see Demolition because I know that very few people did. It got a very, very minimal push in theaters this year, and very few people are talking about it. But I loved Wild, and I really liked Dallas Buyers Club, so that guy gets a shot from me every time. Neighbors 2 is one I want to see. Knight of Cups, obviously.
There's a new Terrence Malick movie, potentially this year.
Yeah, you got to see. And there, you know, a handful of indies, too, that I want to see. I want to see that stop-motion movie, The Little Prince, that's out on Netflix now.
And my daughter is about halfway through that movie, and it looks fantastic. And now, I want to start it over and sit down and watch it with her.
Totally. I want to see the documentary Wiener about Anthony Wiener. I want to see Wiener Dog, the Todd Solondz movie. So there's a bunch of stuff still out there. But in terms of like stuff down the road, Suicide Squad opens this week, and that movie has been absolutely savaged by critics and a lot of fans. It's one of my most anticipated of the year, so I'm going to see it with an open mind. I can't wait. It just looks too promising, and we'll see. Nicholas Winding Refn's new movie, The Neon Demon, is honestly at the top of my list of things I really want to see right now. I love him as a filmmaker, so I can't wait to see that. And I guess the biggest ones coming up, Rogue One, clearly a new Star Wars movie. Sausage Party comes out next week. I'm really pumped for that. But I guess, you know, Sully, you know, sure, why not? La La Land, I love Whiplash, and that trailer is fantastic. So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff coming up.
Yeah, and looking forward to talking to you again in December and not once in between now and then.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.